Welcome, everybody. In case you don't know where you are, that session is called Intertwining Ecology and Art, session number 1507, and it is 3 p.m., April 9th, 2019. And I'm Rebecca DiDomenico, the moderator and a visual artist who draws on the natural world for inspiration as well as materials. I'm most known for my large installations, for example, a cave made out of mica, butterfly wings, and trash. All my life, I've been deeply committed to environmental issues and practiced the use of art as a tool for social change. And so with us today, we have Basha Irland, who is an artist and a Fulbright scholar who focuses on the topic of water. She makes time-based ephemeral sculptures, such as books. Such as books carved out of ice embedded with seeds. She is a fierce watershed protector who frequently collaborates with scientists. Her work draws connections between external watersheds and internal human circulatory systems. She also writes a blog for National Geographic about international rivers, written in the first person from the perspective of the river. And then we have Mary Mattingly, who is a New York-based artist who created the project Swale, a floating food garden on a barge in the Bronx River. She recently completed Pull, a human-assisted sculpture of two spherical ecosystems, which was literally pulled through the streets for the International Havana Biennial. She forges pathways towards sustainable solutions for climate change and educates the public through her compelling installations. And then we have Joshua David, who is a visionary leader best known as the co-founder of Highline and the nonprofit Friends of the Highline. As I'm sure many of you know, the Highline is a world-renowned New York City landmark which exemplifies the integration of art and environment in a public arena. In addition, he is a strategic entrepreneurial thinker and a sought-after consultant for nonprofits. And then finally, we have Tali Weinberg, who is a visual artist whose media includes weaving sculpture and works on paper. She draws upon the intimacy, sociality, and science of textiles to address climate change and other social justice concerns. Tali employs forms such as maps, blueprints, and encyclopedias to challenge patriarchal systems of power through the investigation of climate data and feminist narrative. So we're gonna go in that order, and each one of you has 5 minutes.
Thank you. Can you hear? Before I begin, I wish to thank this land upon which we are meeting that are traditional territories of the Arapaho, Cheyenne, and Ute Nations. I also want to say it's really, really warm in here. I just took my shoes off. So if any of you want to take your clothes off, go ahead. It's really warm. The topic...
Go ahead.
This is, of course, a topic that is dear to my heart because I founded the Art in Ecology program at the University of New Mexico. I wanted to take the students out into the field, away from campus, to work on projects that focused on important issues related to ecological issues involving positive change. As you know, probably most of you know, the word ecology from the Greek oikos, meaning house, habitat for living, and logos, meaning discourse, is defined as the science of the relationships between organisms and habitats, and better describes a more deeply engaged and research-oriented approach than does the term environment. I have devoted my life to working with international water issues and blog for National Geographic about global rivers. These essays are written in the first person, as you mentioned, from the perspective of the river. I am invited around the world to create community-based projects focused on their local streams. One such series is entitled Ice Receding, recedeing, R-E-S-E-E-D-I-N-G. I hand-carve large blocks of ice, some weighing 300 pounds, into the form of an open or closed book. The ecological text on these books is formed from native riparian seeds decided upon in collaboration with botanists. These ephemeral, time-based sculptures are then launched into local rivers with the help of the community as a way to help restore riparian zones. As a visual artist, and we've been talking about this amongst ourselves, I actually find it really difficult to talk about this work without showing images. It's like I lecture all over, and it's like I always have the images behind me so that you all can see this. So you're going to really have to use your imagination to try to think about what these might look like. I also have done a series of Gathering of Waters project, which connect communities along the entire length of rivers. The one along the Rio Grande, I'm from New Mexico, for example, a river that is almost 2,000 miles long, took 5 years to do. Because I often collaborate with scientists from numerous disciplines, I want to say something about the similarities, not the differences, the similarities between art and science. Practitioners in both fields make careful observations, ask specific questions, do extensive research, use specialized tools and equipment, replicate their studies and work, and interpret their results in a broader context. As an artist, I want to be out in the field doing the work, not defining it. But last year, I did accept an invitation to write a definition of the term eco-art, which combines the two terms that this panel is about, for the book Keywords in Environmental Studies, published by the New York University Press. The worms and birds and plants definitely will not care how we define this term, but this is a truncated version of what I wrote. Eco-art involves a transdisciplinary, multimedia, activist-oriented process which addresses environmental and sustainability issues. There is a shift away, and I think this is really important, a shift away from art as commodity and toward new creative possibilities of art in service to communities and ecosystems. Eco-art includes artists who consider it their role to help raise awareness and create actions about important issues in natural processes, invite participation, and devise innovative strategies to engage diverse communities, work directly with others to augment the knowledge associated with particular fields. Eco-artists emphasize collaboration. Many of these artists work with indigenous and local community members, as well as specialists from a range of disciplines. Ethics is at the core of this practice. I also want to mention that I always work closely with local Native American tribes who know deeply the land upon which they live and usually have first rights to water. Thank you.
Mary Madden, thank you. So I'll try to give you a picture of the work that I do. I co-create sculptural ecosystems, but with people with diverse skill sets to build stories. So I think stories can spread through and beyond silos. And I do this by transforming military or industrial equipment or personal objects to try to re-see them as ecosystems, as ecosystem services. I try to do this in urban centers because I feel like they then depict follies. They're out of place. They're something that's unexpected. And then from there, they open up a conversation to potentially the soil, the water, food systems, and even air quality in a way where it's often easy to overlook in an urban center these natural ecosystems and how they provide for us. So what drives me is co-creating, and what drives me is strengthening urban commons, so food, water, air, and land. And I think about thinkers like Eleanor Ostrom who have studied the commons and say
that commons can work when people know each other, trust each other, and work together in caring for a place. And I believe that that can be true, and I live in New York City in a place where it's so heavily regulated that there's often not the chance for that. And I think when there isn't the chance for that, we pull away from that, and then we have expectations about what we can do with each other and for each other and what we can't. And so for the past 3 years, I've been working on a project called Swale. Swale is a floating food forest on a barge. It's a 130 by 40 foot deck barge where you can imagine going on to Swale and you're rocking back and forth. It's usually at a pier. The pier, it moves around from different piers in New York City. And so it's usually tied to a pier. You walk onto it and there's this landscape that's moving. So you're off balance. You're able to walk through the landscape and then pick fresh food for free. And it's meant to instigate New York City Parks Department and public land in New York City to think about what it could be like if they reversed a 100-year-old law that states that it's illegal to pick anything from public space. So you can imagine what that could mean in a city where there are 100 acres of community garden space, food deserts everywhere, and 30,000 acres of public parkland where even turning, I don't know, 10,000 of those ideally over to being forageable, edible landscapes would make a big difference for a city with such density. So Swale, let's see, in 2017, Swale had docked on the Bronx River for 2 years in a row at Concrete Plant Park, and the New York City Parks Department decided to do a test space where you could go onto, you could go into this park called Concrete Plant Park, and they would, they had made a food way, so you could pick food for free 24 hours a day. If this works well there, they might do it in other parks. And I guess I think about how art can be a driver, how art can be one of the steps in building coalitions for change in local places. So I don't think that would apply to Colorado necessarily, where you have different rules, but the art permit absolutely allowed for us to be able to do what we did on the water. And also working with the common laws of the water allowed us to do something that was illegal on land. So I'll just finish by reading some thoughts. Oh, actually, also, just before that, I want to mention that I'm also a photographer. And I think those the work that I do, like Swale, that's public, that's about reusing, is in contradiction to my photographic work. So I study the supply chain of photography, the minerals, everything that it takes to make a picture, everything that it takes to make a camera, and learned that last year there were 1.4 trillion photographs taken that were recorded, and you can think about the social justice potential of one photograph, but also how it's undercut by this giant supply chain, and that's what I've been working on, and I think that could be interesting in terms of a materials conversation that comes up later. So in dominant cultures that privilege fancy trends of disposability, many artists want to revalue maintenance and repair, ecological and social. Creativity asserts our personal voices, but without a creative community, it's near impossible to exercise the power of multiplication, which is where art most often affects change. Creativity often evokes contradiction, tension, and complexity. Our job is to keep tension in balance, or it leaves us unable to act thoughtfully. If we can allow tension to expand our capacities, they can open us up to new possibilities. So I'd love to talk about that. Thanks.
I think I should interrupt. I think I need to interrupt for a second because I'm not getting any questions. And so maybe everybody doesn't realize that there's an app that an app system to send in questions, and also there's a note card system that the ushers can pass a note card to you. So it says tap Q&A on the app and insert and send your question in. So send your question in because I have no questions. and then we're on to Joshua.
Thank you.
Am I a student? If you're a student, we did those first.
Yes.
Great. Thanks, everybody, for coming. I'm Joshua David, one of the co-founders of The High Line, and I just want to touch on three things a little bit. One, the evolution of the High Line itself. Secondly, how it's become a platform for artists who are working in the environmental arena. And third, some thoughts on just practices about the way that we live as artists or architects or designers or activists in our daily lives, and what those practices, the implications of those practices, and how we have to think of the way that we live as well as the way that we create. So the High Line, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, a mile and a half long abandoned railroad viaduct on the west side of Manhattan. It was when I and my fellow co-founder Robert Hammond discovered it in 1999. Discovered is an odd word because it was there in plain sight, but everybody was just ignoring it. It was going to be torn down. The Giuliani administration had made a decision that it was going to rip it down for a neighborhood rezoning of more real estate development. And it really seemed like a missed opportunity, that there was something amazing that could be created there, a mile and a half in length, 30 feet in the air. And what was really compelling about it, one of the many things that was really compelling about it, was that nature had taken over this incredibly heavy, tough, man-made structure, this very industrial man-made structure. On top of it was a self-seeded landscape that had, over the course of some 20 years, created this natural environment up on top. And it was that contrast between the power of nature and the robust industrial structure underneath it, and the sense that you got, as so often happens, nature does conquer the man-made. That was part of the tension of being on the High Line and what made it such an exciting place. Over the course of the next 10 years, we fought to save it, designed it as a public park. Its planting's very much inspired by the natural landscape that was up there, and opened it to the public starting in 2009, with sustainability and environmental horticultural practices very much a part of how we run the park. That said, as you design a project like this, there are always going to be forces competing against each other. We long argued that the very nature of keeping this structure and not going through the very high impact activity of tearing it down and shipping it off to the dump, that was inherently an environmental act. But many of the aspects of the act of conversion of it have opposite environmental implications. We have a concrete planking system, which had to be manufactured off-site and trucked to the High Line. So there are implications of that. We have wooden slats on our benches that had to be made with the wood that would sustain exposure to the elements for a lengthy period of time. There were a lot of initial sourcings of tropical hardwoods that would work for that wood that we then had to remove and not use and find other replacements for them. But always you're doing a balancing act to have the best possible outcome you can. One of the wonderful outcomes of the High Line, besides its popularity and high level of visitorship and the way that it's really created a very vibrant public life, is it's also become a fascinating platform for artists to do site-specific work on the High Line. And a couple of, I'll mention two of them that are really interesting because, as I was talking before this panel started, I'm a little bit of the outlier on this panel because I'm the only one who's not an artist. I made an object, a design object that has environmental aspects to it. But we also act as a platform for artists, and two that we've been very, of the many that we've been very proud to present. One is Nari Ward, who does really amazing installations of found objects, both from Jamaica, where he comes from, and from Harlem, where he lives. And really showing his work really shows how the reuse of these found, discarded objects has both something environmental to say, but something political and social to say. It's very strong political and social commentary in his work. And the same can be said for another artist that we're very proud to have presented, Elana Tsui, from Ghana, living in Nigeria, who also uses a large amounts of discarded items to fabricate his large-scale works. Again, not just with a view towards an environmental message, but to a cultural and social message as well. So it's been interesting to see this natural environment on a man-made structure evolve into a cultivated nature environment on a man-made structure, which then acts as a presentation vehicle for artists who are addressing some of the opportunities and issues that we're talking about today. And then finally, just wanted to talk a little bit about the way that we all live and the way that we live as artists, as conference attendees, as panelists. I think we all flew here. And so that's something that I think we need to figure out what that means as we participate in conversations like this. I was very inspired by the Swedish child activist Greta Thunberg, who in participating in public in discussions like this and doing a really inspiring job as a youth activist, insists that she will only take trains to conferences, or if it's transatlantic, go by boat. I think the how we address what it means to truly live a life that supports the things that we believe in most heavily is a pressing question. How much are we willing to sacrifice in the way that we live? I diligently compost, but I get my berries in a little plastic container, and I don't go out of the way to go to the place where it's not in the plastic container. How many of us, what are the things that we all need to do to make the change that needs to happen to save this planet? And I think a much higher level of sacrifice is ultimately going to be required than what we are, maybe not the we in this room, but the larger we, is willing to put forward. And I think this all means that we all have to be very political and active in the way that we drive forward the changes that are going to need to happen if we want to make this world one that we can still live in.
Okay, now Talia Weinberg.
I'm going to start by just reading a quick quote by Donna Haraway. She's a feminist philosopher of technoscience, but she poses a question using words much more beautiful than I could have come up with myself. But this is, I think, a very important question that guides my approach to my artwork. So in talking about climate change, she asks, how can we think in times of urgencies without the self-indulgent, self-fulfilling myths of apocalypse when every fiber of our being is interlaced, even complicit, in the webs and processes that must somehow be engaged and repatterned? So, of course, the other speakers were talking about this in their own work. So for the last 4 years, the project I've been working on, I've been taking data from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and interpreting that through weaving into these abstracted landscapes. And I'm materializing the weaving with plant-derived fibers and dyes. And so why am I doing this? Data itself is clearly important. It's condensing a huge amount of time and labor and knowledge from across scientific disciplines into something that we can consume or see very quickly. At the same time, some of the benefits of this data are also its shortfalls. So on the one hand, it's actually obscuring its material origins and obscuring, in some ways, I think, the violence that climate change really is on the land and on our corporeal bodies. Climate data, or data in general, is also a relatively patriarchal, capitalist, colonial form of knowledge. So by choosing to weave this data, I'm doing a couple of things. One is pointing, in effect, to some of that illegibility or the limitations of what one can see in this information. And then also through weaving, I'm reinserting time and reinserting other forms of knowledge. So knowledge that's embodied, knowledge that's gender female and indigenous and relational rather than representational. And there are a few keywords that I'll just throw out there that are important to me. Materiality, relationships, empathy, and entanglement. So when I'm talking about relational rather than representational, when I'm talking about how we see, or how I see as an artist, my relationship to the world around me. So as a weaver, it might seem like I have this very solitary practice in my studio, but I'm actually very reliant on healthy ecosystems, which is where my materials come from. The water and the soil and the air all have to be healthy in order for me to make my work. And I'm reliant on knowledges and labor from the people who cultivate those materials, to the activists who are on the front lines protecting our water and our air, the climate scientists who are gathering this data. So it's situating myself within these relationships. In 2017, at the beginning of 2017, I moved from Berkeley, California to Tulsa, Oklahoma. So I had started this project in California, but it has, but it has grown and changed significantly in moving to Oklahoma. So beginning of 2017, what was happening was between the inauguration and the election, climate scientists and activists were rightly very concerned that a lot of data or information about climate was going to be taken offline. And so one of the things that I did was frantically copy this database I've been using. But it gave me another perspective on the data and on the weaving as sort of a, creating a subversive archive in a way, and a feminist subversive archive. And something else that we can talk about more in the Q&A, but in moving to Oklahoma, I'm moving to a historical oil city where people are still very much culturally and economically entangled in extractive industry. And in making my work in Oklahoma, it has really been an opportunity to think about empathy and entanglements in a very different way than I had to in California. And also to really have that embodied experience of living in a place that had been made toxic and dangerous because of these extractive industries. So a lot of my work now is actually trying to think through those entanglements and approach the subject empathetically so that I can have conversations with the people that I'm surrounded by in Oklahoma about the oil industry and the destructiveness of extractive industries, while still acknowledging that all of us are a part of this system. So one of the ways that I'm doing that, I'm producing a project that consists of over 300 sets of climate data, that data that I downloaded at the beginning of 2017, that's materialized as medical tubing, which is a petroleum-derived product that's been wrapped in these naturally dyed threads, and this will essentially become what looks like a very large weaving. But the medical tubing is a pipeline, and it's a pipeline that isn't running through the earth, it's running through and around our bodies. And it's something that is used for medical interventions that have the same causes as climate change. So dialysis equipment and chemo drug delivery. And so this is, I'll stop there.
Closing, okay. If you want to. So I think before we take questions, we could open it up to the panelists if you wanted to respond to anything that your fellow panelists mentioned. Yes?
Yeah.
Tali?
Yeah.
I would love to hear more from Mary about this photography interest and the materiality of photography and how you're thinking about that and how you're approaching that in your practice.
Yeah, so I started to research cobalt specifically because it was in the battery of the camera and part of the lens. And cobalt is, so I can talk about the supply chain. It's intense and it's mostly sourced in Congo right now, but it's also finally being sourced in the United States from a place in Michigan called Eagle Mine. I started going down these rabbit holes of research and realized how intertwined photography was with military extraction on multiple levels, and especially these formative minerals that compose film and compose digital imagery. And so I thought about the poetics as a first way in. I thought, well, what I use photography for is really to continue a story and to, I think that's what allows a story to spread. So when I'm talking about Swale, you do have to be there. It's a very local experience, but the story spreads through the photograph and through writing about it. So I use it in this way that's very elemental to the larger practice. I think about it in terms of students I work with, where I'm constantly insisting that they don't use anything new, yet I am still reliant on the photograph in the document. So I feel like I'm at a crossroads with that. I feel like I would much rather just be making things with collage or interpreting through drawing with materials that already exist. So that's where I'm heading. That's not where I'm at, though.
You go first.
I'd like to address that also, because even though I work especially with the iceberg projects, I'm really interested in that idea of ephemerality. It talks a lot about our melting glaciers, and these icebergs disappear. The whole idea is that the seeds then go off into the riparian zone to help restore those river areas. At the same time, the way that I have written books and give lectures and the way that people know about these is through the documentation, through the use of photography. So again, it's that double-edged sword. I'm really interested in that idea of ephemerality, because each of us are only on this earth for a short period of time, so our own lives are very ephemeral. And people will ask me, they'll say, but Basha, why don't you spend so much time carving these books out of ice, which disappear, why don't you carve them out of marble or out of wood? But it's the very idea that they disappear which interests me. So there is always this.
So Tali, I was interested when you were talking about being in Tulsa and empathy for a culture that has, you called it an extractive culture, I think something, I'm mangling your words, but something like that. We talked a little bit before the panel about living in a red, a fiercely red environment. I was very interested in hearing about that, and I'd love to hear a little bit more about what it's like to be working in that environment, but presenting in that environment as well. Because I think that it's in a way an example of what we all have to do in a bigger way. We're in an extractive cultured world, and all of the work that we do is playing to an audience that is largely cultured in that way. So I'd love to hear just a little bit more of what you've learned and what we can take from that.
So the first thing I'll say is that probably the biggest takeaway is people aren't who you assume they are or who you've been told that they are. So Tulsa is historically an oil city. Before Houston, it was the primary oil producer. It is still very much economically and culturally enmeshed with this industry. This industry employs and funds the city, the state. There aren't really social services, so even the social services that exist come from the foundations that are created out of oil money. My fellowship, the reason that I'm in Oklahoma, is funded by somebody who made their money off of oil extraction. So in approaching the issue, I mean, one thing to understand is that the people you're talking to are reliant on this industry. This is their livelihood in many different ways. And also that in that way, it's not really that different from, say, being in California or being in New York, which are the other two places that I've lived. These industries are just as important and enmeshed in our lives. We just don't see it in the same way. I've also learned that there aren't a lot of climate change deniers in the world, that climate change denial is very much a political tool of the political elite. It's not necessarily the way that everyday people are thinking. People might prioritize climate differently or might not see a way out of our current situation because jobs and livelihood are so important. But I have yet to have a conversation with someone who's come into my studio or come to an exhibition where they can't even engage with the idea that climate change is real. So, I mean, the thing I see in the world right now that I find incredibly disheartening is that people can't have conversations, that we feel like the other side is so far away from us that we don't know where to start. And so I feel like when we can see in ourselves some of what we critique in others, that's very helpful. And and we can see a little bit of ourselves in others who we might not normally choose to do that.
Okay, so I guess we can move to the Q&A aspect now. And there seem to be a lot of questions similar to one that I came up with about next generations or younger people, students and children. And so one question, they said, I do arts meet science installations based on ecological issues. In what ways have you brought children into your work? What are your thoughts on working with children? And it's similar to what I wrote, which is, in these turbulent times, what words of wisdom do you have for emerging artists, scientists, and entrepreneurs navigating the future? How do you encourage activism over apathy? That's a big question, I realize. But I think, you know, given the fact that a lot of people have sent questions in around next generations, that's on people's minds for obvious reasons. So does anybody want to jump in?
Yeah, I've thought about this a lot. I teach a class at Parsons called Sustainable Systems, and it's a mandatory class for freshmen who are coming there from all over the world who have privileges to be there, usually some money, and they are very apathetic, to say the least. They're very discouraged. They think it's not their responsibility. Most of them are enrolled in design careers or looking forward to design careers and are looking at this information and would like to use it, but don't really see a place for it yet. And I was upset by that, and I was thinking about what inspired me and thought about, I think what initially inspired me to make work in general was, well, growing up in a place where, because of the agricultural industry, water had been, was toxic and we had to figure out another solution to well water. And then learning about the year 2000 when Bechtel had privatized water in Bolivia and reading about riots, protests that were massive, how people got together and changed something that felt inevitable. And I showed my students a clip from that, from a video that was recorded from Bolivia at the time. And I think that it really changed them. So I do believe in the power of media and storytelling, and do really think that when we work together and when we do things together, I believe we make changes. And I believe that when people see examples of that, and then they also see a road out of that apathy and can get really inspired and active.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's nice to hear.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it always has to be renewed too. So it's
as a teacher, I'm sure that's something that you deal with a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I can also think of another, I can think of many experiences, but a personal experience was when I was living on a project called WaterPod, and we didn't have trash. So we had a fully self-sufficient ecosystem. No one left this barge. This was the first barge project I did. And 2 weeks later, after the project was over, I remember buying my first cup of coffee and thinking about how nice it was, like a paper cup of coffee. It was just, it was the first time I had anything disposable in 6 months.
Wow. Well.
6 months, but.
Yeah, I don't know. So, yeah, there's a balance.
Masha.
So I taught at the University of New Mexico for many, many years, but I'll take it down to another level, which is the grade school level, because oftentimes when I'm invited into communities, we try to work with all different levels, including older generations, bringing the elders into the discussion. But one of the things that just came to mind was when I was invited to Idaho, and with some of the elders, we were doing ice books. And then when I was invited into the grade schools, what we did was we took the children to the river to dig clay so that they knew, instead of buying clay, that this was clay that they had dug themselves. And then we talked a lot about how various seeds from their particular region help the riparian zone, and we made list of those on the blackboard or the green board. And then once those had dried, and what they did was to make various.
Did you accidentally summon me?
Yes, you were summoned. So we really had fun making fish and turtles and various objects that related to their river in their local area, and that were embedded with the seeds. And then once those had dried, we took them to a bridge, and the kids got to throw those in the river. And so it was really this interactive thing that was really fun with the students. And so that was something that I really enjoyed, that was more at a grade school level than it was with adults or elders. So it was a lot of fun. And I think one of the things that we can encourage at any level for anyone is to engage, no matter what it is to get engaged with your community. And by doing so, I think that can help work on a lot of various problems that we all face.
Just on that note, to build on that, I think when you're working with children, you're working with their families as well.
Yes.
And if you want to build a strong community coalition behind whatever you're doing, working with children is actually a very effective way of doing it, because they inevitably bring other members of their household into the process in some way. We do on the High Line school programs for elementary school students in environmental science, and also in educating people about the transportation system that the High Line was a part of, which was actually a much more efficient system than the one that we now have. It was trains were replaced by trucks. It went out of commission because trucks took over, which are less environmentally sound way of moving goods. We also do a teen program with teenagers who live in subsidized housing complexes around the High Line, to give them employment opportunities in sustainable horticultural practices on the High Line. From the High Line allows them to go on to other careers in sustainability. So I think those, and in both of those programs, parents and other household members are always very, very much a part of it and very engaged in it. And so it's, I feel it's really an essential and very important thing to do. Did you have anything you want to add?
Sure. So one of the things I teach is natural dyeing, which is a big part of my process. And that is a really excellent way to talk to people about the importance of caring for our environment, because when people are learning about color and how to get the colors that they want, how to get their artwork to be the thing that they want it to be, everything affects the color. So what is in the soil, the temperature of the water, the acidity of the water, if there are extra minerals in the water. And so through teaching a number of the media, these conversations come in. The one other thing I wanted to add is in terms of getting past apathy. So it's something I think a lot about right now is care and ecological loss. Because climate change is happening and it's inevitable, and that there is the activism that needs to happen on a political and a corporate level. But it's also thinking about what will it look like, or what does it need to look like now for some communities to care for each other, to care for the people around us as we're facing these crises, as we're affected by these crises. And that also thinking about ecological loss, thinking about the landscapes, the places, the experiences that you've had in your life that are important to you that either aren't there anymore or won't be there very soon, that going through that process of like thinking about grieving for places or environments or animals or whatever it is can actually be a really good way to sort of break through that apathy and think about what else you want to do.
Yeah, mourning is a really important idea, I think. So a student wrote this question. A common issue is the elitist culture of science and the disconnect with the lay community. So how can important scientific concepts, concerns be better available to the public while still educating these scientific ideas accurately? So I'm not sure, Basha, do you want to try that one? Or Mary? Mary, maybe? Let me read it again.
Read it again.
Okay, let's see. A common issue is the elitist culture of science and the disconnect with the lay community. So how can important scientific concepts be better available to the public while still educating these scientific ideas accurately?
I know that often that is the perception about science and even artists as an elite way of viewing the world, but for some reason, I guess I've been really fortunate that the scientists that I've worked with have not had that elite view at all. One example is the chair of our biology department at UNM, and his specialty is schistosomiasis, which is a waterborne disease. I work a lot with waterborne diseases around the world. Like every 8 seconds, somebody in the world dies from a very preventable waterborne disease. So if you just think of the amount of time that this panel has been going on, a lot of people have died from a waterborne parasite. So Dr. Loker works in a lot of communities in Africa directly with the people. There is nothing elitist about what he does. So I'm not sure that's answering the question, but it just has not, because I work a lot with scientists from so many different disciplines, it really hasn't been my experience at all.
Maybe another way to think about that is how to translate information of, you know, climate data, you know, not necessarily emphasis on elitist, but more emphasis on different ways to communicate, you know, what's going on the planet.
So one of the things that I really enjoy doing wherever I am in the world is working with local musicians. And this is a really fun way to get the scientific information out to the local communities, because in a lot of communities, if they can't read or write, they love song, and music is a great educator. So for instance, when I was in Ethiopia, we wrote songs about how to avoid getting schistosomiasis, it's also called bilharzia, and they then translated that into Amharic. They took that into their local communities so that people could understand this. So there was a lot of scientific data embedded in those songs, but they were done in a way that the local community could understand.
Tali?
Yeah. I have lots to say. First, I think most scientists are asking themselves the same questions. For me personally, in my work, I think about our affective relationship to, in my case, climate change and the science of producing this data that tells us that climate change is happening, that when we can create something material, when we can engage with it using more of our senses, so visually, tactily, that those are all ways of being helpful. But the other thing I want to say is that I also think it's important when we're talking about these issues to think about where the knowledge comes from that's really important. So the scientific knowledge is one piece of it, but there are lots of other parts of kinds of knowledge related to climate or related to the environment, other things, other people that we need to listen to. So, you know, what's the knowledge that's coming from the community that's telling us about all of these issues, and how does that intertwine with or modify or benefit the data, the numbers that scientists are producing?
I think Mary a little bit earlier was talking about narrative, if I'm remembering correctly. And I think that's one of the challenges that all specialized fields have is that they develop languages that are virtually indecipherable to outside people. And this is true of architecture. I've translated a lot of architecture texts that were theoretically written in English into English. And done it for other fields as well. I come into this as a writer, and so I think ultimately, whether you're the scientist yourself or you're the artist or activist or whoever you are who are trying to assist in the impactful dissemination of that knowledge, we all need to think about how to communicate clearly with language in non-industry specific terms that lay people can understand. It's a challenge we face in all specialized fields. And so I really urge everybody to think about that as they're trying to drive their issues forward.
Yeah, I guess I would just add one thing. I think that question to me is about engagement and how an artwork potentially can engage someone who comes to see it around issues that scientists are highlighting with their data. And I think about, in terms of, I'll talk about Swale. So when people come onto Swale, they're able to pick food for free. And the first thing people ask is, where's the soil from? And then they ask, well, where's the water coming from? Is it coming from the river? And so then we talk about our water filtration system that's pulling river water up and cleaning it and how it's doing that. And so I think in these small ways, people become engaged with through their food with these other ecosystem services. And then you can talk about the grocery store and how you really don't know any of the answers to those questions when you go there. So, yeah, so I think in terms of storytelling and engagement, there can be really simple techniques to getting to a larger, more holistic picture.
Yeah, I think it's a fine line between communicating in a simple enough way for people to understand and then not being binary about it, you know, not being oversimplified. So there was a comment here, comment and question, mostly about Joshua. It says, Joshua is absolutely an artist. His medium is the whole community, not just the High Line. Could he or the other panelists speak to their favorite social activism engagement?
I was talking to somebody a little bit earlier today about the origins of the High Line, I came to it in one way, and the other co-founder, Robert Hammond, came to it in another way. Partly I came to it as a writer who was doing research on my community and became aware of it, and then became deeply involved in my community as a part of bringing it forward. But I think I was made able to take up the challenge of the High Line by activists that I'd seen before me in New York City around AIDS, specifically the organization ACT UP, which was a coalition, they still exist today, but in a less prominent form, a coalition of really amazing, dedicated community members who took on an issue that nobody knew anything about. They were complete lay people. They did not come from a place of scientific or pharmaceutical or medical backgrounds, and ended up immersing themselves so deeply and learning so much about what it took to take an AIDS drug to the point where a person could take it. They ended up learning so much, they knew as much or more than the scientists, and were able to affect incredible change from a place of just no real expertise. And so to me, that was the story of the High Line as well. None of us knew anything about what we were taking on, but we weren't architects, we weren't attorneys, we weren't elected officials, we weren't foundations, we weren't any of the things that we weren't landscape people or horticulturists. We weren't any of the things that you might need to be to do this. But we were able to create a coalition of people who could gradually bring all of that knowledge together in one place and draw it forward. And so that's, I think, to me, the community meets activism message of things like the High Line. Does anybody?
Favorite social activism?
Sure. Oh, well, this might not be my favorite, but it's an experience that I can draw from. In 2013, I was part of a larger project, and I didn't really know the scale of the project, but I was invited to set up a sculpture in the Lower East Side on this old pier that used to ship bananas into the city, or that used to be a receiving point for bananas coming into the city, and then became a dump. And then after Hurricane Sandy, it was being cleaned up and it was slated to be developed. And so six community groups in the neighborhood got together and they said, we can stall this development with art. So I'm really fascinated with how art permits sort of play out in public space. So they engaged artists in a 3-year project where artists installed sculptures in this park, in this what is now a park, was then a pier, and got enough people interested in this and got enough people to learn that this was actually going to be slated to be developed into a condo instead of the park that they wanted. And yeah, during that time period, they were able to transition it. And I think that that kind of grassroots work is really mm-hmm. exciting and a way that art can kind of fit into a social fabric in a different way, I think. And using art permits, you can sort of skirt some of these larger things that are happening.
Tali,
Basha,
favorite activist
projects? Well, there are thousands. Both Mary and I are part of an online eco-art network, and there are hundreds of people from around the world that are part of this. So there are a lot of artists doing the kind of work that we're talking about. We're certainly not rare. There are many, many people who are engaging with the environment. I might just mention, because we're just talking about writers, a close friend of mine, Dara Jamil, has just written a book called The End of Ice. And if you have not read it, I would highly recommend it. There have been several panels, quite a few panels, on climate change and ice in the Arctic and all of that. But what I really like about this book is there are so many books on climate disruption, he doesn't use the word climate change, on climate disruption, and they're all data-filled. And so his book, he writes for Truth Out. His background is as a journalist in Iraq. And he went around the world interviewing top scientists about this. So he was coming at this from an activist standpoint, of engaging directly with the people and going to the Amazon, going to all the coral reef in Australia, going to all these places directly himself instead of doing it as a research-based thing. And for me, that's really important. Again, I mean, I can't state that enough, is to get directly involved with the communities, whatever it is, especially the community where you live.
Can I just add one thing?
Sure.
Sorry, I'll be super quick. The other thing that I think has just been very impressive lately is the work of activists, many of whom are artists, to bring to the fore, in particularly in New York City and in cultural institutions in New York City, where certain funding is coming from, specifically opioid-related
yes.
funding in
yes.
in museums all over the U.S. and in Europe, but very much in New York City. And I think what's really impressive about the work of this group of artists and activists is they've gotten to the point where major cultural institutions are now stepping back from this funding source, which is a much bigger step than you might think it is. And I speak from the point of view of somebody who's had to raise these monies. When you have this fundraising goal every year, you're very reluctant to get too deep into where the money comes from. This group has had a tremendous success in recent weeks, but I don't. The same group of people who've been trying to bring attention to funding that comes from environmentally questionable sources has not had the same record of success, at least in New York City. Those continue to be ongoing discussions that don't have meaningful outcomes, where this one has had so far a very significant and strong outcome.
At the Tate. Also, they had yeah. huge protests mm-hmm. where people covered themselves in oil.
Yeah, there was actually one like that at the Louvre, that not an alternative, it's a collective of artists that they did, where they snuck in actually molasses. It was supposed to be representative of oil because of the viscosity and the color, and then they dipped their feet, their stocking feet in it, and walked through the museum, and it was supposed to represent BP, financial support of the Louvre, and actually ended up having, positive outcome, or so I heard back then. But that kind of speaks to this question that came, which I think is about, intense emotions. Here it says anger, but I think it could be interpreted as any sort of intense emotional response over environmental destruction by our materialist society. So this person, I guess, is asking, how do you deal with anger and intense emotions over this, destruction that we're facing, environmental destruction?
Make art.
Mm-hmm. It's a tough question.
Okay. So I think anger comes from love, and we can find empathy in anger. And I also think that, that is real. I think that there is space for a movement that's opposite to the movement of the sway that advertising has. And I think it's really exciting me to think about repair and maintenance as something that's as great as disposability, mm-hmm. and trying to get that message forward, I think we can do as artists, I think we can do as thinkers, as advertisers. I think that sort of flipping that script is what would be driving me in that with that comment.
Tali said make art, which is something I certainly agree with. But I also think that we need to, in whatever way we can, very heavily invest in leadership, whether that be political leadership that can change things in a dramatic and meaningful way, or organizational leadership of the organizations that are really leading the charge for positive change. We've got major elections coming up where there's, as we can see with the current administration, how bad an administration can be. We can also have one that is as good as this one is bad. And I think we need to invest extraordinarily heavily in making sure that happens.
Yes, agreed. I said it flippantly, but I really do mean it. When you're processing intense emotions like anger or like grief, make something, whatever that means. You don't have to be an artist, but what does it mean to put yourself out into the world or just that feeling of making? But I also think it's really important to think about where anger is directed, because the last part of that question was about anger towards our materialist society. And I do think that we often, as environmentalists, I saw this a lot in Berkeley, we get caught in blaming each other or blaming ourselves. And really, the scale of destruction is happening beyond us. It's happening at a corporate level and at a government level. And that has to do with the systems that we exist in. So how can we think about our relationship to those systems and how we change those systems? That, to me, is where the anger should be placed.
All right, coming to the next question. Somebody wrote in, it's difficult to be an ecologically minded artist under capitalism. How do we resist the system while simultaneously making a living during ecological collapse? Can we support each other in ways while still facing the truth about the environment? So I think that's kind of two different questions, but you know, the first one is, you know, how do you make a living as an ecologically minded artist under capitalism in a way that has integrity? I guess that's how I would rephrase that.
No money is clean. We live in money.
I'd like to hear more on that, please.
No money is clean. The world we live in, as an artist, the majority of my funding, some of it very directly and some of it very indirectly, we're part of this system. We're not outside of it. I don't have an answer to that question, and it's certainly something I think about, but the other related thing that I think about is being a woman artist, and how challenging it is to have your work make money or have your work be commodified. That there's actually, I want environmental art, or I want women's art, or I want the art of people of color or trans people to be valued in the same way that the art of straight white men making abstract paintings is valued. So it's not really the answer to the question.
We only have a few minutes left, so does anybody else want to say anything other than answer that question?
I mean, I think we can ask more of the organizations who do fund artists, and I think that, you know, before we take funding from an organization we don't agree with, we can ask for other things to be in place, and that's maybe one way to move that dial slightly. I do think it is a contradiction that we are within, and I have more to say on that maybe in a few minutes.
Well, 3 minutes. Does anybody have anything else that they really were burning to say before we're at the end?
I mean, it would just be great to hear from people. I wish we could open it up and it would be more of a conversation.
Kind of a discussion.
Mm-hmm. That is kind of hard. It used to be like that at the conference. Mm-hmm. They eliminated. Now all the questions go to a business.
I'm sure there's
more. I'm going to make a quick plug. Just in case people in the room don't know, the CU Boulder Art Museum right now has an exhibition titled Documenting Change, and it's artists and scientists interpreting or representing climate change in different ways throughout time. So there's a walkthrough tomorrow morning, I think at 11, of the exhibition, but it's also free and open to the public. So if you haven't been, I encourage you to go.
And I'll also add another plug, because in that same museum tomorrow, I am giving a lecture with images. at 2 o'clock. So I welcome all of you to be here.
There's also a climate change exhibit at NCAR right now, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, for the rest of the month, which is
cool. And Joshua, I believe you're giving a talk at the Boulder Museum as well, right?
Yes, yes. So I just want to—I just want to give a nod to my three co-panelists who are all so fantastic. It's just so all of your work is so inspiring, and I feel like I've learned
really,
so much.
Really,
this group. It's really, really fantastic. Also to everybody who's here and cares about this as a topic. You know, this is the. We face many challenges in this world today, but I think, you know, for me, this is the climate change is the single greatest existential challenge I've ever seen in my life. And we all need to give everything we possibly can to finding a way to make it less terrible, if not actively good. Let's try the less terrible. But I'm very glad that you're all here thinking about this and caring about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you to all the panelists and to the audience. Thank you so much.